as we spend it more and more and we make more mechanical gadgets, they use it. But the spoken word is the basis behind it. Detachment of love. The Greeks had two words for love. The first word was agape. Mm-hmm. And agape is something like this. And the second word is eros. And you're eroding. So when you get attached to the erosion, you break down. And out of that came the word erotic. It's the attachment to the contact with. So in eros, we say to the next word, I'm in love with you. Automatically, you program the opposite by saying, I am in. What would be the opposite now?
Out.
Because nature abhors a what? A vacuum. She doesn't want you to go fly that way. That's why the Chinese people say the whole world is yin yang. Going, there's no that or that. It's interaction upon itself. So we don't have, and out of that came your left brain, right brain interaction. The attachment is a fixation. And it's in the fixation and the attachment that the Buddhist teachings came up with, the idea that suffering is in the attachment, not in the desire. But they didn't know how to say desire and explain it as a principle, so they said the word desireless. To be desireless is to be detached, and that's the pure love. That's how they explain it. But when you really understand the word desire, it comes from the word sire, to rule, and de is dual, and to reproduce. So anyone who has a desire, they have a feeling or a craving to do two things. To build up a certain structure and then to involve in a certain repetition. But the fixation of the repetition and the attachment to the repetition is where the agony is in the process. So if you can disengage from the fixation and the agony and relate in a flexible state, then desire is a rational function, because God himself desires to create, but he is not attached. That's why he took off on the sixth day. You see, now if he was totally attached, he wouldn't take off on no day. But this is to say that in the body, we have what is called rest periods. And attachment is a function that creates this anguish in love. But then, nature, knowing that this would be detrimental to the mechanism, provided a phase down or a safety valve, unconsciousness, sleep. This safety valve was to preserve the mechanism from eroding away through the attachment. Now, you may love someone and you're attached to them. And when you fall asleep at night, how much attachment have you got? You see, nature is trying to show you that you can't really be attached to anything external. You can only be attached to the internal structure of you, a sperm and an ovum put together within a matrix. That's why we finally end up loving people
and then we have to let them be what they are. We can't take away their individuality from them. And the more we love them with this freedom to be themselves, sooner or later our own true nature goes up. The compassionate nature, the compassionate love emerges. Otherwise, possessive love will erode. Possessive love will create anguish and violence. But the compassionate love forgives. But that's hard to do because when somebody aggravates you, hurt you, you don't want to forgive right away. You see, it's not so easy to turn the cheek. It's quicker to hit him back. That's natural. It's difficult to do the other, hit you and then turn. But I was fortunate to see where that principle worked. Normally I grew up in a martial art family where you hit and you get back. And it's the mosaic law, a knife for a knife, a tooth for a tooth. And though I grew up as a Christian, Catholic, studied the priest, left and I went to study radio engineering, I have never seen the principle of turn the cheek. And Jesus said this, if you're somebody hits you, turn the cheek. This was in, one day I was in Canada, and I was going into an elevator. And there was a tall Frenchman who was drunk, and with a short Englishman that came in, and I was a third person. And the drunken man was didn't know what he was saying. You doggone limeys, you walk, whap. And he hit the guy one blow in the jaw. And I said, hey man, wait a minute, you got this, you can't do that. And he held me back and said, don't worry, man. So I thought he ended. He turned his jaw like that. And the guy is still drunk, and he went on, you down the line, and I was, wham! And the second ago, by that time I was ready to throw the guy out of the elevator, bigger than this. He shouldn't do that. The guy called me back. And he turned again the jaw the third time. And the Frenchman lift that hand to hit that guy. And to this day, the hand never came down. He was like that. He didn't touch him because if he touched me, I wanted to learn a technique. What was the martial technique that he touched this guy? He would stay like that. The elevator stopped, I came out, and the English fellow held the Frenchman by the hand, brought him out, left him there on the edge of the elevator, started like that, and he's going on the road. I know this man has been hit very hard. And I ran after. I said, come on, man, I want to know what you do. And he looked at me and said, I learned this from your people. My people? No, not you. There's no worry to be believing that. He said, well, I was in Burma. I was hurt. And given up to death. And some monks found me. And they rescued me, and I grew up in their place, and they fed me, and I got them. And it's in their temple I learned this technique. I said, what technique? He said, turning the cheek. He said, I learned martial art there. They taught me. And then when you're ready to leave, one of the monks will come up, big, huge one. He said, are you ready to take your test? And so you know, that's how it was a test. He said, well, you have to stay up like that. And he would whack you one. And you have to turn his cheek again. And he'd whack you a second time. And turn the cheek a third time. And I said, well, come on, man. You have to hit that man somewhere. You have to do something. You're not telling me. He said, no. If you stood the second blow and weren't destroyed, he says, he had to go through because he saw it happen many times and go to pass the test. All he had to keep in his mind, turn the cheek. And he said, the third time the monk tried to strike, the hand would stay like that and lock itself. He knew that he had mastered the art. And then the monk will hug him and said, now you can go back anyway. And he got his health back. He left and he came back to England. Then from England he came to live in Canada. But then I met him. That was the first time I've ever seen anybody apply at the martial art level this particular principle. Because I know where you, in the art, somebody hit you, you hit back. And we grew up with the idea that if they hit you and you get up, make sure when you hit them, they don't get up. That's how we were trained. But that is again the sonics and the spoken words. turning the two. The mind can say the mantra, the mouth can say the mantra, and the body can say it. And the three of one. And that's the same thing with the love. Then the attachment and the loving the person compassionately, you have to go into compassion. So the more compassionate you are, you know that that person has endured a lot of pain. Because I don't know of any person gaining compassion without pain. Take a child, all right. You have your most beautiful china, and he reached up to take something off the table and knocked on your beautiful china. It cost you a fortune in the first place. Maybe you just smash it in the pieces. You're going to be angry because the beautiful thing will be broken. But then, if it's your first experience as a mother and a child, the portion of you starts to expand. And that's the compassionate nature. And so the compassionate nature overrides the attachment. The compassionate nature allows you to flow. And so we have both conditions, the agape and the eros, in ourselves. We got both. We have to bring the compassionate now to override the erotic or eroding process of the love, or the in and out movement of love. And if we can do that, we are free. But again, it's not an overnight process. I couldn't tell you it's an overnight. I don't know of anyone overnight arriving at this state of being detached and loving. It's a lot of pain and anguish involved. But if you can stick it out and don't panic, the love will demonstrate. I think the hardest thing in love between two individuals is the not knowing how they will react, and we panic before we find out how they will react, and that panic puts us into an abrasive level, or abusive level, or a violent level. But if we don't panic, and we can just coax along or coast along with the situation, in a strange way, it starts to phase down. But panic seems to be one condition that aggravates destruction. But you have this consolation in love. Jesus never said that we could love without attachment. He merely said, love the Lord thy God with all of your mind. Now, all of your mind, you don't have time for the other person. So you've got all is already inclusive to you. And with all of your heart, so very little of it is going to drift away to outside. Of course, you've got to be focused on the inside. And with all of your strength, that's your respiration, because you don't have strength for life without breathing. And with all of your soul, that you don't have the sense of identity without being alive. So this love is first, this is why they call that the agape. You're involved in the unification of yourself. It's the next sentence that is very, very challenging. And your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't say like yourself. You can't really love nobody like yourself. But you can love another person as yourself, because they're involved in the same process of finding their own identity. And then you have to allow them to be. And when you have the understanding of how you put together, you can see why they are what they are and what is holding them from expressing. Because they are born within a certain time frame, they have certain emotional feelings, and they have to live it up. And that's what they call the horoscope. They call it the scope of the horror. Because each person has one moment in which they come in with a lot of anguish. But that is the person they have to work it through. You come in at a certain time, you have to work it through. The three wise men went looking for Jesus, and they found him at a certain time. So they knew that the scope is involved in each person. You can't shift that. So we can only truly love ourselves. It's not selfish in the first place. It's the understanding of how we put together. Then when we understand that, we can love the next person as ourselves, like a reflection. And the compassionate nature emerges more to work with that person. And that's why they tell us that we have to learn timing. The man Solomon put that very clearly when he was alive, that there's a time, a place, and a season for everything. Time is your health. Place is your pocketbook. And season is the relationship. If the person is hot or cold, you gotta warm them up or cool them down. So how you relate to a person is the temperature reaction. Where you want to make your fortune, that's the location. So they say, go west, young man. Or go east. But find a location where it's practical for your pocketbook. You can be in the wrong place and starve, you know, or be in the right place and not starve. So that's the basic law of supply and demand. Timing is your health itself. In the wrong place, at the wrong time, you get sick or you get an injury. So that's what you have to watch. So when it comes to attachment in love, love overrides, but then each one has a specific function. To relate to another human being, you're going to meet many people, and not all can be. And that is why all teachers or people who realize will tell you this. We love the world, but we can't be involved with the whole world. Those who respond or synchronize are the ones who are going to relate to us. And those who don't respond and synchronize are not ready. And you can't go push them. So when you live with a friend or relate to somebody, and there is no connectedness, you have to let them be, or you'll be fooling yourself. It's an understanding that you have to come to, and not to be afraid. See, the thing is this, ancient people used to study the horoscope of relationships so that when people got together, they would be compatible. Today we find that in biorhythms, compatibility. So we haven't learned anything new. In fact, we're becoming more and more specific and more practical in our understanding of our nature. The universal love is with us, but our specific personal relationships is necessary to have some guidance in it. You know, you can fool yourself in love and then end up hurting yourself more. And yet if you understand it and accept it, you can flow with it. And if you spell love backwards, you see why it's difficult to live it all the time. because you're constantly evolving. You never have an overall look. See, and that's one of the things you begin to see in the spoken word, the very principle is locked up of the anguish and the frustration and the release. When you look at the anatomy of the body and how it operates, then you can understand why the wise man says, be in the world, W-O-R-L-D, but not in the W-H-I-R-L of it. Don't be caught up in the movements of it, because you'll get sick, you'll get angry, you'll get frustrated, you'll get violent. So, learn to accept the person as they are, and if they accept you as you are, in the end, the relationship grows. But if they can't accept you and they try to mold you, and you're trying to mold them, you end up doing what? Breaking up. And I don't know of anybody molding anybody. We can only mold ourselves. And so, for that reason, the wise people and the realized people all tell us, pick up your cross and follow me. Pick up your own ideas, pick up your own reality. Live your own life. And you will automatically attract people. And here's a good example. When you walk into this room, you look at the many chairs, and yet you ended up in one chair. Which you felt what? Comfortable to be sitting in that one? That's what we're talking about. It is a sort of sensing the compatibility or the comfortness or the comfortableness at that location, at that spot. And that's the same whether you're relating to another person. How you feel, how you're trapped and relate. And if you're in doubt, go to sleep. You know right away, you can't carry them inside your head. You're enough to witness when there's no way. Any other questions? You had a question you were asking me of repeating a certain mantra and what it would do. All mantras, whatever the phrase or the meaning of it, gains its momentum from the time it was started. And you can actually get some kind of transference because others have used it so long that it intones a unification with your mechanism. And it will help to arrive at a certain quality in yourself. But there's a handicap in repeating a mantra in a foreign language that you don't understand what it means. Even though you give it the best of your intention to repeat it identically and want to be part of those resonances, a part of you is fighting. There's a story that goes like this. They say there was a war going on between an asura and a deva. And the asura was repeating a mantra that the deva was repeating. And they both were repeating the same mantra, but the asura mispronounced one of the words and blew himself apart. So, what that is telling us is this. We get songs given to us and we grow up and hear it. And it has done a great deal for many people born in that particular language structure, fine. Others come into it. Somehow, deep down, they're not getting the full benefit of it. It is because you have outgrown that particular level of repeating that particular sonics to your mechanism, and that you are in a new language structure to get the understanding of the sonics in that other language. Now, in Tibetan language, Om Mani Padmani Om, and you'll go on louder and louder yourself and over and over. For as far as some people born in this part of the world, Om Mani Padmani Om don't mean a single thing in their head. But they'll repeat it, because it seems to have some kind of intriguing pull on their mechanism. And they can lose themselves in it. And yet, deep down inside, something is holding back. What does it really mean? Why am I talking English? Now, it's hard to say I and the Father are one, because right away that creates conflict in English. And yet, Om Mani Padmani Om, if you translate it, may also mean you and the Father are one. You see? But because it's a foreign language and it doesn't challenge any identity of ego in you, you will quickly relate and say. But when you get back to English, now, where the intimacy comes in, and not to be threatened with the fact that it's a foreign language and you may gravitate to it because it seems to have more of a heritage, the challenge and the contribution is in the present language structure you find yourself in, and the understanding of what those sounds mean, you have greater sense of intimacy, greater sense of identification with the sonics, and then the love is intensified. That's why the people who learn foreign languages, in my researches over the year, all the years back, many of them showed up to my clinic with all kinds of sicknesses. And they were studying foreign languages. And one of the owners of the foreign school used to come there for a problem with his nostrils. And I used to laugh when he tells me about he has a sore throat and everything. And I said, you know, if I tell you the real reason of your sore throat, you wouldn't come back. He said, why? I said, first thing, you're studying a foreign language. You're trying to repeat the sounds exactly as it is given in the tape or the way it told you to say it. He said, yes. I said, you ever think for one moment that the person who recorded might have a cold that day when they said it? And you're actually intoning the pronunciation with the cold symptoms in it? And so what you do is, I want a trunk tail. I'm calling it a nostril that day. And so he goes around speaking it in that room. I've heard a lot of people learn English from foreign countries and come over and hear the tape, buy the tape to learn, but never think for one moment that that particular day that the person was recording might have a cold. And they're trying to repeat it. And they end up with really knows a knock. So, intonation and symptoms are related. So, that's why, in as much as sonics does actually control the atom, the Tara Veda is a model of what can happen if you pronounce the wrong sonics. You know, they say the Tara Veda. They are building this big, wonderful tower. And the problem began, and after a while they couldn't understand what they're saying to each other. But think for one moment, this tower is about 100 story high. And you're at the top mason working, and you turn to the person next to you and say, in that big window, go past the brick. And he says to the next person, pass the brick. By the time it gets down to the bottom, it's being sung like, you're a hick. So everybody went babbling their own way because they didn't know what the hell is it. See, his sonics can do things like that to us. So they said the whole tower stopped building. The intonation of the voice and the atoms are very, very synchronous.
We have a, by Sai Baba organization, we have a translator. Mm-hmm. And Baba has told us to speak in our, to sing our bhajans and sacred songs in our native tongue. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of resistance. I've been one of them who didn't resist. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we sing these Sanskrit songs, there's a mantra effect to them, and the vibrations seem higher. And what you just said is sort of a contradiction of that. Is that true or not?
No. The mantra sung in Sanskrit gained its potency by the many years of repeating it down through the centuries and brought to the moment where intense devotion built around it. But it's done in a ritualistic way without understanding. Many of the people who are repeating the mantra don't know what a mantra actually means. They're just repeating sounds. Now, I went to the reservation one time and I heard them repeating chants. And I was surprised to hear them say, Mary had little lamb, she had white snow. When I was saying it in Navajo, and I thought it was a big ritual. All they were really doing was run around doing nursery rhymes around a fire. See, but they were saying it in such a way, to hear it and not understand, you think it was Navajo. But they were saying English, Mary had a little lamb, so fast that it sounded like Navajo. You see? And this is when I began to check it, a lot of things that the people were doing, they were having a joyful moment of singing like children. Nursery rhymes. But the more they gave it intensity and devotion, it began to have more meaningfulness. So I can see why Sai Baba says sing it in your own native language than to try to sing it in Sanskrit, because the actual understanding of the word is not carried over in your consciousness, and that's more important than the mere repetition of the word. Like Om Mani Padme Hum. They've been repeating it, knowing what it fully means. They get the full intensity of the meaning. You speaking it in English may not feel intensity in the start, but when you work up to the intensity of it, then it begins to take effect because of the understanding of what the word really represents to you in your time frame. And that you have the same result. What is the same result between saying it in English with more intimacy of the understanding or saying it in Sanskrit from the heritage of it, is that when you reach a certain crescendo of intimacy, your consciousness opens. And both English or Sanskrit would give, but you would feel a deeper sense of intimacy because you're born and grew up speaking English. Versus one who's born and grew up speaking Hindi or Sanskrit, their sense of intimacy is different. But if you can shift in the understanding of the words, and that's more important than the actual words that you're saying, is the understanding, then this is universal. To get the understanding of the word. And the, to me, is the any word that you can use that gives you the intimacy and the understanding is the most important experience. So if it's English and you can intimately respond to it, fine. If it's German, whatever it is, where the intimacy is the strongest in terms of the understanding of the word. So when they say a person prays to God and their prayers are answered, and it didn't matter what language they prayed in, as far as God is concerned, He's granting the intimacy of your understanding, the experience. Because that's basically what you have to live. Did it answer your question? Yes?
What if someone would say grandparents migrated from...
I can't hear.
Let's say someone's grandparents migrated to Germany.
Yes.
They didn't grow up with them in Germany. Would there be passed on an unconscious level an intimacy with that language through the grandparents?
Yes, that is transferred. And that's how come speaking in languages came down through the centuries. And I've attended many of these Pentecostal movements where these people are slain in the spirit and born again, but none of them spoke English. Even in Africans that were slain in the spirit, they always spoke some old ancient language. I don't know any in modern day Pentecostal movement speaking in tongues ever spoke in English, even as a modern nationality that never spoke English. They never spoke those statements in English. They always spoke way back a language that was in ancient time, and it was always a prayer that they were repeating. Those who could translate it always came up with a prayer that they were praying to God. What would be outstanding is if an African who has the experience of the Pentecostal foundation, who never spoke English in his life, starts speaking, "Praise the Lord, praise the Lord, praise the Lord," in English, and then we know he's made a tremendous advance into the future. But if he's going to say something like the Maya and it's way back in Egypt or some other ancient country, then it's something from the memory bank. It's when they can talk away from the memory bank into something that was future, that would be different. They have, we have never seen or heard of any person in any foreign country speaking in tongues, speaking the experience in English. It is always a language of the past. And that's what boils down to a different experience when it comes to a mantra, that though our grandparents may be chanting away and handing it down through their mechanism, when we come to apply it, if we don't have the understanding, a part of that is going to phase down in ourselves. It's the understanding that is very important to what you're saying with the science. So if you apply the technique, and what is the technique, to the language you're speaking, the result will show up. And the technique is audibly repeat the sound, mentally repeat the sound, or resonate it through the identification of the respiration. This technique is very simple, has been with us, and we can't improve upon it, we can only live it. But it requires a certain quantity of repetitions to make it go off.
What was the third one?
The identification with the resonance of your respiration. Your breathing makes a certain sound.
Okay, but not the text language.
So if you have to identify that. But that's the three methods of a mantra or a repeating or a sonics.
Whenever there's an earthquake and the earth opens up and houses fall under and everything, that's a pretty abrupt type of thing. It doesn't seem like it's happening on a subtle level. But from my own personal experience, it seems as though, nothing was as powerful as an earthquake. It all seems like it's kind of like on a real subtle level, to the point or it just seems like a whole waste of time. You see what I'm trying to say? In other words, an earthquake is something that's very powerful. You feel it, you see it, and sometimes people fall in.
Yeah, but then there are those who say, "Shut and go away, go someplace else." Wait till you meet one of those people. Go someplace else. And wait until you meet one of those people, and then you'll know the power of the spoken word.
Well, what I'm saying is that I don't think I understand what you're saying. I know
you don't understand what I'm saying. I said, wait until you meet one of those people who will say, "Shut up, go somewhere else," and that's pretty much.
Okay, no, so that's abrupt. I'll admit that. That's like a monster too. I understand that. But what I'm talking about is like all these mantras, basically, that we hear about, that many people hear about. Okay, in other words, they all seem like they're on a subtle type of level, to the point where whatever they're supposed to produce, they're really not producing as intensely as if you were to feel an earthquake. They all seem like they basically like a very solid thought form that's really not accomplishing too much.
You just don't feel it.
Well, right. It's on a very subtle level.
It's happening right now.
Right. I agree. But it's not as intense as if this building was shaking and the vaults were opening up and the safety deposit boxes and everything was flying out.
Maybe you just never want to speak about the meditation.
Well, you don't have to meditate for an earthquake. It just hits in its own time.
You see,
it's very intense. Sure. You think that some diners say a mantra?
I think we all say it.
They might have a better mantra than we do up here. You might be right.
I'm going to put it this way. There was a teacher who lived, and he was on a boat sleeping, and the boat was drowning from the wind, and his students began to panic, and they woke him up in their fear of drowning, and he looked around and said, "O ye of little faith." And then rebuked the wind by saying, "Peace, be still." And the boat stopped drowning, and everybody was happy. Now, you know, wind is very powerful. It lifts up waves to cover a whole country. It'll even flood and cover up an earthquake. An earthquake don't even have the strength of a wind. Yet the spoken word stopped the wind. Based upon that credit card and the owner of the credit card who said, "The things I do, you do also, and greater things shall you do. And as many as receive me," right there in that present time frame, "unto you, given the power to become sons of God, even unto those who believe in my name," not present at that time frame. That's a credit card that doesn't have any revoking no more. It can be used by another human being in another time frame to blow up the planet if they want and reshape it with their voice. But is there a need to blow up the planet, reshape it with a voice, or to rebuke the wind, or slow down the earthquake? The last earthquake would have taken a place called Carpinteria, California, on a certain night, But there was a person who slept that earthquake and told it to go someplace. And 4 hours after, it blew up in Mexico. When Yogananda was alive, an earthquake came through California and began to shake the building that they were living in. And one of the girls saw the earthquake and began to pray desperately for something to stop the building from falling down. And Yogananda looked up and said to her, "What's wrong?" She said, "Master, there's an earthquake going on." So he says, "Ganesak," she was wearing a muumuu, and he called her Ganesak. "You take your shoes and hit that wall and tell that earthquake to go home and don't bother us." She took her shoe, hit the wall, and says, "Go on home, don't bother us." 3 hours after, the newspaper had this printed, and the radio had this message: "Strange earthquake comes to Los Angeles in the afternoon, disappears in a strange way, only leaving one building empty in the downtown area, broken. There is no other evidence of fallen buildings. Where the earthquake has gone, no one knows, but it came in a strange way and left in a strange way." Now, that spoken word told to someone to take their shoes and hit the earthquake and send it home. Now, let's look at another phenomenon of an earthquake. The earth is made up of elements, right? And it's held together by all 144 elements having dominion over the earth. Even though the earth came before the human being is given the power by the creative intelligence through the spoken word to have dominion, not ownership. Dominion, that means the right to regulate its behavior by the spoken word. The most that the earth can ever do is separate in a hole called an earthquake, blow up like a flame called a volcano, or sweep the whole thing off clean with the wind, or spin so fast it burns itself into a star. Yet the human voice can't regulate. But we sell ourselves short. And that's the problem. The anguish, the frustration, and the fear, the panic, and the sense of feeling limited, is those make us feel we don't have the power to control it. But the question comes up, controlling it for what purpose? What is it we need to control it? Earthquakes have to happen. Tornadoes have to happen. Hurricanes have to happen. Volcanoes have to happen. Living and dying has to happen. It is when the person who applies the laws, that moment they will be given the ability to manifest it, and not before. 1,000 people can be praying for rain in a certain location, and in another location the rain is falling when the people don't want it. The time is not for those who want it, and the time is for those who don't want it. And yet, not too long ago, I was in an area where people were praying for rain. It was so dry. And the last day of the prayer, the rain came. But you know something? They never specified how much rain they wanted, and they got so much rain it flooded away the place. So watch out where you pray for. Yeah, our sonics have that kind of phenomenon. We set up the desire for a need, and we don't realize the specifications of what that need is. I know it's difficult. We would like to manifest magical powers. But let me ask you a simple question. We are arriving at a stage in time where the miracles will no longer be possible to perform without some kind of a imposition. Number one, raising the dead would be a great miracle, right? Good. Imagine you walk to the graveyard and raise the dead, and the IRS is present to pick up the income tax from the guy when he comes with the coffin. Who is he going to light up? He's going to want to crawl back in his hole in his room, because you don't deprive him from his non-confrontation with the IRS man. Now, if you manufacture too many fishes and loaves, the FDA is going to come in and challenge you for a while. Yeah. So miracles eventually go to run into a standstill, because every law function is going to make it impractical. You see what I'm saying? And that's why Paul is rebuking society by saying, I rebuke you in your rejoicing, because I live and die daily in the Lord. The actual reality is more important than the magical reality. To manifest the things, and then they run into a dead end. We see they're not really practical. Now, what is more important is these three words and what they actually mean to each one of us. Spirituality, divinity, liberated. Or enlightened. What do these three words actually mean to the human being? We have all kind of concoction ideas of what those three words mean, but they're not functional and they're not practical. Yet a spiritual person, in the true sense of the word, is a very, very practical person every moment of their life. That's how we know they're spiritual. They're not churchianistic, and they're not holier than thou. Those are not spiritual people. A spiritual person is a person who is very practical every moment of their life. Now, a divine principle manifesting in that person to indicate their divinity, how divine they are, and if they're truly divine, is measured by their immunity to disease. And it's been proven that many of the divine people had the worst diseases, and they couldn't understand how they had it. And they were still living and functioning without falling apart. That is their divinity. Their tremendous immunity to the reaction of the disease going on in their body. So we have spirituality as being practical, momentary, and divinity as immunity. And last but not least, truly enlightenment. Enlightenment has nothing to do with intellectuality. The enlightened person is one who can act on command performance. The moment you ask him or her to do something, they're willing to apply it. That's command performance. They don't have excuses. They act what they say at the moment. So we know we can put those three qualities into our life and live it every day. You can start the process of being practical every moment instead of being fanatical or impractical. You can start the process of improving your immunity, and you can start the process of responding to serve and not afraid to act. And this is the highest accomplishment of a spiritual being. You will be guaranteed the immortality of your souls. That's a fact. Now, there's a book called The Incorruptibles, where there are over 360 case histories. And the bulk of the case histories are women. Nearly 80% of the case histories are all women. So you see, immortality has nothing to do with how smart you are. It's how
smart you are. In the clinic there at home for 3 days walking around with a gallon bottle on their tummy. After that they said, you can have pregnancy. They knew what it was to carry that gallon bottle there. And weird. But what was comical about it in the end, they said, you know, the first day was aggravating. And the moment they began to relate in their mind what a woman would be enduring, the strength started to increase. I said, that's the first thing that happens in the person when they start to become pregnant and when they start having the child, how the body starts to gain strength. And when the child is born, how it gains more strength to lift it up and move it around. And not too long ago, I was up in Flagstaff. 2 years ago, I saw a child, how small they were. And 2 years after, I saw that same child, how big it was. And I saw the mother and the father lifting it up and carrying it. And I said to the mother, I says, where did you get the strength? She says, that's the whole joke about it. The more the child grows, the stronger I get. Mm-hmm. I said, you haven't changed your lifestyle in eating. She goes, no. The strength and the energy seems to emerge out of it in the challenge. No. But with the father, he was never there, he's long ago been working. But the mother's got to lift the child. I said, this is the thing that creates this particular immune level in the body, the challenge of the aggression. The body builds up its own immunity to cope with it. And it, finally, it will prove out that the non-breakdown rates are in the immunity level, in the challenge level. The greater the challenges you have, the greater the immune level.
no challenge or request. So we review ourselves or realign ourselves with the understanding more than the magic of our true nature, what we do, how and what can be accomplished. Once you understand that, all miracles are performed. But let me put it this way. A great sister of mine said this statement to me. Adam, when you know God, all your good and all your practical and impractical decisions are fulfilled. The day you know God, all your practical and impractical decisions are fulfilled. In other words, there is no sin. But you've got a bunch of impractical decisions that you have to account for, but they are fulfilled nevertheless. And the practical ones are the ones that you feel you can don't threaten you. So she was putting it in proper perspective, that since there are no sins in the world, it's only impractical decisions. When you really think of it, it's valid, because you wouldn't have made the decision to act it had you know how practical or impractical it was. But you have to go through it.